Hey, everybody. You know what I purchased today? I purchased something which I have not purchased in quite a long time, and this purchase was significant. Well, it wasn't significant, but it was significant when I realized how long it had actually been since I purchased this very particular item. I bought a cymbal bag. Now, those of you that know that I play with the Philadelphia Funk Authority know that I carry all of my gear around in my car, and amongst that gear, of course, are the cymbals. The plates, the dishes of brass upon which I clang so wholeheartedly. And I have had the same cymbal bag since high school. I realized today that I have had three times as many cars as I have had cymbal bags. Now, the cymbal bag is just a big nylon bag that holds your cymbals. And the thing is that the cymbals are stored on edge, so that edge slowly over, let's say, 20 years, digs in and sort of tears through. And the inside of this thing has just been shredded to pieces. So I have this nice black piz, which is the technical term. I have black piz all over my cymbals. And just for years, I've just accepted the fact that that bag has black piz in it instead of buying another bag. Well, since the hole, much like the crack in the current season of Doctor Who, the hole in my bag is just appearing more and more often, and it just finally came time for me to buy a new cymbal bag. And it was like, oh, okay, I'll bite the bullet and I'll spend $20. So, like I said, I have had, since high school, four cars and one cymbal bag. I don't know. It must be like, you know, how guys refuse to throw away underwear. It's the same kind of thing, I guess. All right. Let's start the show, shall we? This is the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 30th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening.
And we have a special guest rogue this week. You may have guessed if you're familiar with this podcast already, but George Crabb is joining.
Hello,
George.
Oh my God.
Hi, George.
That was the lamest hello I ever heard.
Thank you.
I was going to say that was the second lamest hello I ever heard.
Yeah, it was timed right, though.
Well, George, thanks for taking time out of your busy recording schedule to join us on the SGU. We've had you on before, but this is your first time as a guest rogue.
Yes, I'm very, you know, any time I have to be a guest on something that involves studying beforehand, that's always very exciting. So I've got my notes right here in front of me, and I'm all set to go.
You've got hard copies?
Yeah.
Okay.
See, I'm old school, man. Handwritten on yellow paper with one of those big square pencils you would get in kindergarten. That's what I still use.
So before we go on,
for safety.
Our podcasts have a lot of overlap, but there may be some people listening to us who haven't heard the Geologic podcast or listened to your music. So, George, give us a brief intro about yourself.
I have a show called the Geologic Podcast, which has nothing to do with geology. Well, 0.02% to do with geology. It's a silly show which just has a nice skepticism bent to it. It's nowhere near as organized as your program. It's more about the sort of mad ravings of what happens to me throughout the week, both as a professional musician and as a skeptic trying to deal with things in the world. In my day job is playing drums for a funk band out of Philadelphia, and in my spare time, when not doing the podcast or doing the drumming thing, I record albums that tend to have music which is in somewhat of a skeptical, scientific, nerdy kind of bent. That's the quick Cliff Notes version of what I'm about.
And your latest album, Trebuchet, is just out, correct?
Yes, we just released it last week. It was put into my feed, my podcast feed, and a bunch of other podcasts very generously put into their feeds as well. If you're remotely interested, it's show number 170 of the Geologic Podcast. It's a 70-minute album, 17 songs. All 17 songs are in that show for free. You can go check it out. We're trying something different this time. It's the first time I've released an album and been doing a podcast at the same time. So we decided to put the whole mishpucha into the feed and see what happens. And the response has been pretty positive so far.
Awesome.
I should hope so. I enjoyed the album tremendously, George. I thought it was really, really great.
Oh, thank you very much. That's very nice. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I'm happy with it. I'm happy with it.
George, I had dinner with my parents, and my mom tries to pretend like she understands what a podcast is, and she asked me, so what are you guys talking about on the next show? And I said, oh, we're having this awesome guy on that has his own podcast, and I told her your name, and I told her, you know, a couple of doodads about you. And she's like, well, what's his podcast about? And I was like, well, he just kind of tells us what he did over the week, and then he makes fun of
and that's interesting?
People. And, yeah. So I give her this totally lame explanation, and she goes, uh-huh. Okay.
She should talk to my folks. They'd get along great, probably.
Jay, you didn't tell her that George actually speaks to his mother on the podcast, did you?
No.
Okay, good.
That's not happening on our show.
Is that some kind of invitation now to...
Because you know that conversation would veer into politics.
Well, you know, it'd be like, oh, we talked to his mother on his podcast. I see.
He likes his mom. He includes his mother.
It would have something to do with being careful in food. Right. That would be the topic.
Right.
Evan, what's special about today?
Today, July 10th.
Well, when it's released.
It was back in 1997 when scientists report the findings of DNA analysis of Neanderthal skeleton, which support the out-of-Africa theory of human evolution, mm-hmm. placing an African Eve at 100,000 to 200,000 years ago.
That's right.
And she was played by Meryl Streep, right?
Oh, probably, yes.
Is that a different thing? That's a different thing. Never mind. Sorry.
Now, of course, the fundamentalist creationist immediately latched onto that. And I remember watching, for whatever reason, the 700 Club at the time, Pat Robertson saying that scientists have discovered that a woman named Eve is the ancestor to all humans. No further context.
It's hard to believe, but apparently there's this one woman. She's just science has proven that Eve is just she's the first woman, and there you go. It's just amazing. Yeah. It's just amazing.
That was good, man.
I mean, so because the scientist called her Eve, he said her name was Eve.
Yes. Yeah. And missed the whole mitochondrial Eve thing, where it wasn't the sole female human ancestor, but just the one whose mitochondria eventually, you know, dominated in the population. But anyway,
so he thinks that they spoke English back then?
Well, he didn't
name her Eve.
Well,
he probably thinks they found her dinosaur license, Jay.
Right. I mean, you know, they tend to latch on to anything sciency that they can twist to say it supports their beliefs. I also remember another fundamentalist telling me once that scientists have discovered lakes of fire on Venus. Therefore, the Bible is true. Because it mentions lakes of fire.
Lakes of fire. Quod verit demonstrandum.
There you go.
QED.
Look, a burning bush.
That's it.
But Steve, there was a real scientific controversy, that this helped.
Yes, this was a very exciting piece of evidence. Yeah. It I don't think it put the debate to rest, but it definitely was a huge score in the out of Africa theory column, which still predominates the notion that the different populations of humans, you know, migrated out of Africa and then diversified, as opposed to evolving in situ. You know, Asians did not evolve in Asia versus, you know, Europeans in Europe. We all evolved in Africa, migrated out, and then spread around the world. Those are basically the two competing hypotheses.
But Steve, didn't it also demonstrate the bottleneck that the human population went through?
Yes.
Where our population went down to, what was it, 10,000 members at one point?
10,000, I think.
Something like that. Yeah. I mean, it demonstrates that fact, I think, very well.
Right. And in fact, though, I mean, I remember at one point looking deeply into the question of the bottleneck, and I don't remember if I wrote about it or if we talked about it on the show, but there may have been multiple bottlenecks. It's actually a really complicated, you know, paleontological question at this point. Or there might have been what they were calling like the Coke bottleneck or something, where the really long bottleneck, as opposed to a brief one. You know what I mean?
Mm.
A long giraffe over.
Is that geographically also, or is that just, is that like a single bottlenecks happening simultaneously, like, or is it just bottlenecks that happen in time?
Well, this was one where basically the entire human population that led to us, doesn't, there could have been other humans at other places, but the population that eventually led to modern humanity passed through a very, very small population period. And that period of time might have been a very long period of time. That's the question. How many of these bottlenecks were they? How long did they last? And this is basically being answered by analyzing genetics, the genes of different populations of people around the planet. And this mitochondrial Eve story was really the beginning, from what I recall, of that kind of analysis. At least it was the first big major story to come out of it. And now we have 10-plus years of subsequent analyses that are really deepening the story. And, the, you know, out of Africa is still, you know, predominant theory. The multiple bottlenecks, you know, are starting to be fleshed out, although it's certainly a long way from being completely settled. So,
well, how much evidence would it take to kind of overturn what we've learned in the last 10, 15 years? I mean, it would have to be a pretty significant chunks of evidence in order to go back to...
Yeah, I think it's getting...
I think some other theory.
It's getting pretty solid. I mean, it's like at the 90% level or something, just to put an arbitrary number on it, meaning it's pretty solid, but not at the point where it would shock me if new evidence started to move in the other direction. I just think it's, you know, we're definitely in favor of the out of Africa and the bottleneck hypotheses.
I wonder how much genetic diversity there'd be if we hadn't gone through such a bottleneck. I wonder if it would be striking, or if it would be just something that you'd have to, you'd have to really look to really see the increased genetic diversity.
Yeah, that's tricky because, you know, one thing a lot of people don't realize is that the amount of genetic diversity within Africans completely dwarfs the amount of genetic diversity among all the rest of humanity.
Right.
Right. So there was another bottleneck more recently that led to the population that then radiated around the earth. So, you know, Asians and Europeans and Scandinavians, you know, they're all descended from a more recent small population with very little genetic diversity comparatively, whereas the genetic roots of Africans are much deeper and therefore they have much greater genetic diversity just among them. But that's not really apparent to the eye, you know what I mean? It's in the genes.
What are the percentages you're talking about here in terms of diversity? It's like, it's really tiny.
It's
right?
Very it's tiny. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It's less
tiny,
it's less than a percent. It's very, very
less
tiny.
Than a percent. Okay.
Yeah,
yeah.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, let's go. There's actually another evolution story that we're going to touch on quickly. Scientists, this is also another genetic story. Scientists have been fleshing out the evolution of the fish fin to the vertebrate limb, the terrestrial limb.
Yeah, this was interesting. This was an interesting one to do some research on. It's one of the more iconic images of evolution. It's that of an industrious fish crawling out of the water, right, to be the first animal to walk on land. I could see the image in my mind. I'm not sure where I even get it from.
The Far Side.
Was it The Far Side? I'm sure they did a lot of them.
Muddy Mudskipper,
love it.
But the details about this, details about this transition from water to land have been kind of hard to come by. We do know that about 365 million years ago or so, some fish fins evolved enough into limbs to allow them to actually travel efficiently on land, becoming the mighty tetrapods, which were basically the first vertebrate land dwellers. And these tetrapods, of course, eventually became reptiles, amphibians, and mammals, of course. Obviously, fins aren't very useful on the land. But, you know, we've all tried to walk with swim fins on, haven't we? Not very efficient, is it? How did fish fins become tetrapod limbs then? The first step in this transition, Steve had mentioned, may have been uncovered recently by scientists as they described in a recent journal, Nature. What they did was to inhibit the expression of a set of genes in a zebrafish embryo. And the results, when that fish finally fully developed, the results were fins that were dramatically shortened. Now, according to Marie-Andrée Akimenko, she's the biologist and one of the study leaders, if this kind of gene expression happened in an ancestral fish, that may have led to limb development, she said. Now, you know those bony supports inside the fins of some fish? Can you kind of see these like bony little projections with the fin skin kind of between them? Those precursors, the precursors to those in the embryo, they're called actinotracheae, which are these slender thread-like fibers that are in the embryo. These scientists, when they inhibited those genes, they prevented these fibers from developing in the embryo. So the idea then is that without those embryonic fibers that become the bony, you know, the bony projections within the fins.
Yeah, the fin rays, they call them, right?
Yeah, right. They're called ray-finned fish. It'd be easier for the limbs and digits to eventually evolve. So you get rid of those, and they think that you have a good kind of a foundation for limbs and digits to eventually evolve. Now, the two interesting facts about this, two facts that I think best support this theory. One of them was that all the land animals that they investigated, they did not have these genes. They could not find these genes at all. And I assume they also couldn't find a mutated version of them either.
Yeah, I looked for that, Bob, because that would have been cool. Imagine if there was a pseudogene, an inactive version of that gene in terrestrial mammals. It still may be there to be found, and that would be awesome.
Right.
Because genes could be inactivated, but they could also be eliminated completely. So.
Right,
but it's a better artifact of evolutionary history if they're inactivated but still present. But
yeah, that's
it's
true.
Not necessary.
Yeah, it would be very cool if they did find evidence for them there. But the suggestion here is that those genes have just been lost into evolutionary history. The second one, and this one is the second bit of evidence that supports this, which is even more interesting, I think, was that they carefully studied a zebrafish embryo and a mouse embryo, and according to Dr. Akimenko, she said that when we compared fin development and limb development, the early steps are very similar, but at one point there's a divergence, and that correlates with the beginning of the expression of these genes. So the timing seems perfect for that, and it seems like their theory is on a good foundation. So I tried to find out what's the next step here. What are they going to do? And what they're going to do is they're going to insert these genes into mice and see what happens. Now, that could have be an interesting result. Now, as interesting as this may be, this is really just the outer edge of the puzzle, right? You know, there's still lots of missing from this puzzle. How did the fin actually change into the eight digits that are found on each of the limbs of the oldest tetrapods? They don't have five digits like we're used to. They've got seven or eight of them. So why did eight predominate at first, and then how come the five digits are common now? So there's lots and lots of questions that need to be answered. But I've got two problems with this. And Steve, maybe you might be able to help me out on this, but I've got two problems. First, don't you think that you would think that stunted fins would be selected against, since it's quite a disadvantage, right? Like, oh, wow, I've got my fins are really tiny. How are they going to survive, first of all?
It seems Bob, you're really assuming, but you're assuming that it was lost in sequence, right? So all we're saying here is that
two of them, right? It could have been asymmetrical loss.
Well, first of all, yeah, they didn't necessarily have to both be lost at the same time.
Right,
and
right,
also,
okay.
Remember, there's hundreds of millions of years of evolutionary history between the modern tetrapods and modern fish, the mice and the fish that we're talking about. And now we're trying to reverse engineer what were some of the major steps, evolutionary genetic steps along the way that sent a fish fin down a different developmental path. Clearly, I think they've identified one key set of genes that do send the limb down a different path from the fin to something that could, with other changes, turn into a limb. But this absolutely does not require or mean that at some point in time there was a fish with a fin who lost these genes and then had a truncated fin. You know what I mean? Because other mutations and other changes could have occurred first, and then these genes were lost.
Right. That one objection. Yeah, I figured it wouldn't be too hard to knock that one down. You know, just on the surface, it seems like, wow, you know, if this is true, then it seems like a pretty nasty disadvantage to have. But all right, Steve, how about this one then? This one, I realized this just like a half hour before we started taping. I was like, whoa, what the hell? Isn't it generally accepted that lobe-finned fish evolved into tetrapods, not ray-finned fish? So does that fact severely impact this research? Because, you know, you've got two different types of fish, really. You've got the lobed-finned fish that have like this fleshy, strong fin. You know, the base of it's really kind of strong and flexible. And it's those lobed-finned fish with a air sac that evolved into lungs, you know, and the lakes dried out. That's the conventional wisdom on what evolved into the amphibians and reptiles and mammals. But then the other side of that coin are the ray-finned fish. Now, these are the fish that, when you think of a fish, that's pretty much what you're thinking of. All the fish you think of are ray finned fish. There's really only two lobe finned fish extant, and that's a coelacanth and the lungfish. They're like the only two that are left. But it's generally believed that they are the ones that evolved into tetrapods, not the ray finned fish. So why mm-hmm. so why are they doing research on the ray finned fish if we didn't really even evolve from them? You
so
know what I mean?
I guess the question is, what's the evolutionary relationship between the ray finned fish and the
yes.
lobe finned fish?
Right.
And is this really, and this also might in fact address your other objection, in that does this just explain more of the early evolution of ray finned fish into lobe finned fish and then subsequent down that pathway into tetrapods?
Right. But I'm just surprised that such a fundamental thing is not addressed in any of the research that I read. Nobody like said, oh, by the way, you know, it seems like a gaping anomaly. Like, what? What's
yeah,
going on there?
It sounds like something we need to talk to an actual researcher
right.
about. You know,
right.
And it certainly isn't in any of the lay articles about it.
I thought the lobe fish assumption with the coelacanth was just that. It was just an assumption. It wasn't really that they were. So the coelacanth is near and dear to my heart because my fourth album was called Coelacanth.
Yeah.
And the fact that it sort of has these. That its fins / legs kind of point straight down. I thought it was just presumed that might be leading to some kind of, you know, truncated arm kind of thing.
Yeah, although we have Tiktaalik now. You know, Tiktaalik is a transitional fossil between lobe fin fish and tetrapods that kind of supports the lobe finned ancestor hypothesis. But it is, you know, it's not impossible. Because this happens in evolution all the time, that the lobe-finned fish could have been just not the ancestors to tetrapods, just another branch of fish that developed along similar lines, but were ultimately just parallel or tangential to the ones that led to tetrapods. And we need more information about the early radiation of different kinds of finned fish. You know, one leading to rayed finned fish, one leading to lobe-finned fish, maybe another one leading to something else that led to tetrapods, but just had some, you know, some derived similarities with lobe fin fish. Who knows how complex, you know, the root of that tree really is.
Right.
You know, so that wouldn't surprise me either. There's a lot of possibilities here, but we're definitely digging deeper than we're going to get superficially from what's been published.
Yeah.
Maybe Bob, you and I will just need to track down somebody like the authors of this article who can take it deeper. But let's go on to Pat Boone. Now, George, you sent this article to me. Pat Boone is trying to enlighten his readers on the World Nut Daily. I mean, World Net Daily.
Right.
About about some physics. He gets into some discussion of physics on his...
Yeah, it's sort of the invocation of science in a place where he really quite shouldn't be doing that. Pat Boone, of course, is the famous singer from the 50s. He was the spokesman for Chevrolet for a long time. He was the guy who so famously would re-record what they called race music at the time, which was music that was recorded by black, you know, African-American artists. He would re-record his version of Tutti Frutti is really something to hear. It's quite Caucasoid in its wonderfulness.
Yes.
So that's who Pat Boone is, and he has become quite a thumper of late. So he wrote this sort of blog entry thing, yeah, the thing that was up on WorldNet, and the idea behind it is that he is saying the name of the whole thing is "Wake Up, Folks! The Game is Rigged," and what he's sort of trying to do is he's trying to relate the idea that the universe, or sort of the way God runs the universe, is akin to a casino, in that everything is sort of rigged towards God winning, which is very strange. He starts this whole thing. He talks about, you know, have you been to Las Vegas? And you realize that, you know, even though you win a couple times, you lose. Well, why is that? Well, it's because the game is rigged. He goes on then to start relating how all the rules of science are created by God, and that they're not invented by the people that sort of find them, but they're discovered by the people they find them, like Copernicus, like Galileo. He says this thing, the game is rigged. The one who created the worlds, the cosmos, who breathed into creatures his own image and the breath of life itself, the one who hung the stars on the planets on nothing, who spun the planet on its course around the sun, the one who fashioned everything from a physical trinity of light, mass, and energy, the one is the owner, the establishment. You know, again, really purely scientific terms he's using here. and he says he makes the rules, and the rules are heavily weighted in his favor, blah, 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 blah. Now, whatever. If you want to, my take on this was, if you want to relate the grand creator of everything to someone akin to a casino owner that is relying on your misunderstanding of basic mathematics and probability, and is relying on your stupidity and the misunderstanding of probability, if you want to relate your boss to that, then that's your prerogative. What really kind of upset me here was that he starts talking about science, and he says he invokes the Wright brothers, and he says, you know, the Wright brothers they didn't invent the laws of forward motion and the physics of lift, but they discovered it. And he talks about Copernicus, and you know, Copernicus, since the Bible mentions hanging the circle of the earth on nothing. Of course, that proves that Copernicus was actually sort of following the example of the Bible. So he talks about Copernicus, and he talks about Galileo, and he talks about Isaac Newton, and he talks about Thomas Jefferson, and he invokes all these people to sort of prove his argument that, you know, they just found these and explained these laws that were already pre-established. That to me is really kind of ballsy a move, I think, because when you look at how Copernicus was received by the early church, the same God, by the way, that Pat is invoking here, or what was done to Galileo, or kind of the initial hesitancy to Pasteur's research in terms of providing some kind of immunization for people, as well as, you know, Newton and Curie and Einstein and Hawking, and even mentions Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. He talks about Thomas Jefferson invoking God in the Declaration of Independence, which is a bit of a doesn't quite invoke God in the Declaration of Independence. And also the fact that Thomas Jefferson, you know, wrote his own version of the New Testament, where he removed all of the references to Jesus's divinity and the miracles. It's shocking that it seems Mr. Boone wants it kind of both ways. He wants to be able to say how great science is because, you know, God has made science so available to these people, whereas pretty much everything that all the people he's listed, every step of the way, they have been fought against by, you know, those in power within religious thinking. And that just absolutely fascinated me. The pure, for lack of a better term, sack that it takes to write something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he basically has one point to make, and that is that the laws of nature, the laws of physics, are what they are. Okay. You know, that's yeah, it's kind of, yeah, it's a vapid kind of point that he's making. It's, you know, it's sort of like, well, yeah, well, duh. But then he sort of tries to massage that into some deeper points, which don't really gel. And I agree. Right. I think the metaphor of the gambler who runs his own casino has implications that maybe he wasn't thinking too deeply into.
Sure.
But even if we put that aside, so what's he saying? You know, the fact that the laws are immutable, that somehow relates to the fact that they were created that way? Or, I mean, it's just really grafted onto his belief system.
Exactly. You could have Satan running the whole thing. That's like, you know, you could have any deity creating and grafting these rules.
But it does seem that he's trying to downplay the difficulty, the work, the intellectual fortitude that went into making these scientific discoveries. You know, they were just like, people were just tripping over the laws that God was throwing at their feet. That's not exactly the way it happened.
Yeah, he's trying to make it like St. Paul, you know, that on the road to Damascus, where all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, theory of relativity, or Bernoulli principle. Oh, okay.
Right.
And that's not the way it works.
The Road to Damascus was a Abbott and Costello movie, right?
It was my favorite one, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
It really is a horrible analogy.
It's terrible.
I don't walk away with any positive feeling from that at all. I mean, I can come up with a lot of really sleazy comments about his analogy, but nothing that kind of has a feel-good to it.
It's funny because I didn't get a chance to read this before George started talking about it. And as he's describing it, I'm thinking, and therefore, what's the grand conclusion?
The
and then
exactly.
then that was it. It's like, wait, you've got to be kidding. That's all there was to it? Oh, man.
Right.
Well, he's supposing so many things, you know? Like, I'd be curious to know what he thinks God's grand end game is. You know, like, if it's rigged to what? To what goal? To what end?
Right. Well, he ends this whole thing with saying, even today when some seem hell-bent on undermining our democracy, destroying our economy, and changing the rules, it won't work. The game is rigged. And to me, that's kind of like sleep. sleep.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You're fine. Yeah. Sleep.
Ignorance is bliss.
It's rigged to whatever
I
say it is.
Sleeping. Yeah. Don't think. It's so, fine.
Don't think too much.
So everything's going to be okay? Is that it? Yeah.
It's
don't think too
much. It's almost a little insulting, too, like when he's saying, I hate to be really nitpicky about it, but when he's like, and they're trying to ruin our economy. Who are they?
Exactly, yeah. It's the non-existent they. And then just invoking science. I mean, if you want to have this belief that, you know, the game is rigged and it's rigged in your favor, that's fine. But, like, how dare you say, just like Copernicus or just like Galileo, you know, they were on the right track and never mind what actually happened. But they were, you know, they discovered the majesty of the universe and how beautiful it is. The fact that they were completely fought against every inch of the way, you know, by the very same organization that he is representing. On some level, right. It's a branch of a branch, but still that same thinking process. That's what's so, like, believe what you want to believe, it's fine, but don't try to have it both ways of saying, look what these guys achieved, and isn't it great they could reveal the majesty? It's like, no, they revealed what was there, and they worked their tuchus off to get to that point, and it really has nothing to do with what you want to, you know, sort of do in your own time with robes and candles and whatever you want to do.
He's trying to cop a free science field.
Yeah, that's basically it. He also said that Edison was not an inventor and that Galileo invented the telescope, which is not true. It was in wide use prior to Galileo. Galileo was just one of the first, not even the first one, to turn it to the heavens and use it as a scientific instrument. He was just the most famous person to do that first.
Right. And Pat Boone has a really horrible toupe, so that personally I take an affront to that.
Jay, tell us about ice patch archaeology.
I love this. This is so cool. I mean, if there's anything about global warming that is good or interesting, this is really cool. So at the University of Colorado, there's a research associate named Craig Lee. He has been studying glaciers and ice fields that have been melting because of global warming. And around the year 2000, they realized that a lot of artifacts are coming out of the frozen landscapes. You know, pretty much wherever these glaciers and ice fields are melting.
But not glaciers, Jay. He's very clear to say that glaciers, because they're moving, are actually not a good resource for this. It's the static ones. It's the ice fields that never fully melt in the summer, so they're permanent patches of ice and snow, but not glaciers. Just to be specific.
Okay. Detached from any movement.
Yeah, they're in place. They're what they call kinetically stable, as opposed to glaciers, which would be grinding things up and wouldn't be a good place to look for artifacts.
So as time is going on, as these ice fields are melting more, we're actually going back in time in those ice fields. So the frequency of these things appearing is increasing. Like recently, he found an artifact called an atlatl dart.
Yeah.
And, oh, cool.
That dart, it's a 3-foot-long spear-like projectile, and it's shot from a weapon called an atlatl. And if you've ever seen that movie Quest for Fire, it was like a really, you know, caveman-y looking weapon that they use. But basically, it's like a stick that has an end on it that you put the spear in, and then you kind of huck the stick, and with a fulcrum, you throw the dart, right?
Yeah, so, it gives you leverage. Yeah. It's
like an arm catapult sort of.
Yeah, it's a game changer. That was a game changer. Totally.
I mean, it's not as good as a longbow, but it's better than just throwing a spear. Yeah, so it's somewhere in between the two.
So if you got some, if you're fighting somebody with and they have a spear and you have an atlatl, you win, assuming you're accurate.
Yeah, you certainly got range on them. Yeah, that.
Yeah, from a pure range point of view, you got them.
So he found this in the Rocky Mountains at Yellowstone Park. And what they're doing is they're putting together a database of all the different ice fields that are – I don't know if it's global yet, but he's definitely doing it in that area. And the bottom line is that this is a new field of science because there's a whole spectrum of things being found now that didn't have any other place to find them or whatever. They're finding things like plant material, clothing, tools, animal carcasses and feces and all of these things.
Right,
you know, we're jam packed with an enormous amount of information. You know, they're just
feces.
But feces tell us a lot of things.
Diet, proteins.
I know that. Yes,
fiber.
It's human garbage. It's human
bacteria.
He says, in these instances, what we're finding as archaeologists is stuff that was lost. Maybe you missed a shot and your weapon disappeared into the snowbank. It's like finding your keys when you drop them in the snow. You're not going to find them until spring. Well, the spring hasn't come until these things started melting for the first time, in some instances, in many, many thousands of years.
Yeah, I think that he estimates that that atlatl dart was, what, 10,000 years old? So the key here is that mostly archaeologists deal with rock and stone, things that are permanent. But he, now they have this window of opportunity. Yeah, this window of opportunity to look at organic material that once it's exposed tends to rot away very quickly. So archaeologists have to essentially go rushing around the world trying to find as much of this organic stuff that's eroding out of these melting ice fields that maybe
is it just sitting on the surface. I mean, is it are they just like finding this
stuff?
Yeah, or are they digging for it?
No, no, they're just finding it. Yeah, yeah.
There was snow there when these objects were left initially. So it wasn't like these left on the ground and then covered at some future point. So they really are like super preserved.
Yes, that's right.
Wow.
But how can they can still accurately date it even though, say, it's dropped in level? Like when something's buried in the dirt, you know, there's other things around it that you can make an exact comparison.
Well, it's organic.
It's snow.
Yeah, carbon
dating. It kind of falls.
It's organic. You can carbon date it.
They age it by the age of the ice. They know how old the ice is.
But then it has to at least be partially samples, frozen.
Right? Yeah.
Right? It has to still be in situ then. It has to be still stuck at least partly in the ice.
Right. Yeah, but George asked a good question. It's kind of almost comical to think like there's like these frozen things that are just kind of half frozen, you know, half sticking out of the ground. Like, are they stumbling on these things? Or are they actually digging or using any kind of surveillance to see if
it? He stumbled on this dart, and good for him for recognizing it. The damn thing looks like a stick to me. But he noticed that the end was hafted, you know, that little thing, that was it. And he said, wow, that is – and it was all bent out of shape and everything. It wasn't like a totally straight like it would have been when it was used. It was distorted, I guess, by being frozen for 10,000 years. But he had a great eye. He just noticed that the hafted end on the stick, that it had to be a crafted dart, that there was a stone tip on it at one point.
You know, I think finding dinosaur bones and things like that are awesome, like in its own way. It's such an incredible find. But it's also really cool to find stuff that humans were using, you know, these tools and stuff. Like, I'm dying to find out more about the things that they're finding.
Yeah. I hope they find a spaceship under the ice. Just don't thaw out that alien.
Don't thaw the alien, right?
The fact that those people that were using that stuff were genetically pretty much identical to us is something that I always think is so cool.
Yeah.
That these are, they looked like us, they had the same capacity for thought, they had whatever, just didn't have iPhones, you know, it's
culture,
it's amazing.
Is different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's it. But essentially, genetically, you know, or physiologically, they're identical. And it's
close.
10,000 years ago.
Close.
It's really close.
I mean,
it's closer than the Flintstones would have us believe. I mean, it's pretty damn close.
Yeah, they're modern humans, but and the reason why I back off and say close and not identical is that in the last 20 years or so, geneticists have discovered that humans are continuing to evolve, and in fact, there are some proteins, some genetic variations that are associated with greater intellectual capacity that are actually increasing in the frequency in the population. So we may be smarter than they were. And also just from nutrition and other things, I mean, there's the average IQ of Westerners is actually increasing by 3 points a decade.
Wow.
And we're not even really sure why that's happening. So, but that could partly be nurture as well. Again,
of this podcast, isn't it?
Yeah, well, absolutely.
Mm. And yours. And
God
yours.
Bless you, Jim.
Well, a couple more quick news items. We've talked in the past about skeptics getting sued by cranks and charlatans as a intimidation tactic to try to silence legitimate scientific criticism, most notably Simon Singh, who endured a couple of years of lawsuits from the British Chiropractic Association. And now there's a new one of our medical colleagues, Stephen Barrett, who runs QuackWatch and who's been a tireless advocate for science-based medicine and critic of all kinds of dubious practices, is being sued by a laboratory company called Doctors Data, Doctors Data Inc. And he's being sued for, in my opinion, correctly pointing out that a lot of the tests that they offer are dubious and bogus and actually support practices which are themselves either fraudulent or substandard. And it is a clear intimidation tactic. They had their lawyer write him a letter saying, basically, you need to stop,
cease and
take
desist.
Take down all the critical articles, you know, completely and issue a retraction and an apology immediately.
Oh,
right?
Wow.
But, you know, Barrett's very savvy. He's been through this before, so he knows what to do. And he wrote back saying, I'm very dedicated to accuracy. Please point out any factual errors I made in my statement, and I will
Beautiful.
Happily correct them. I will yep. research them and correct them. So he's establishing that
awesome.
My intention is to be accurate. If you give me anything I'm missing or anything that's incorrect, I will research it, and I will correct anything that needs to be corrected.
In the meantime, pound sand.
Right. We left that out,
well,
but that's the in between the lines. They wrote back to him saying, cease and
oh,
desist.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically saying, oh, yeah, you better still not pointing out any actual errors. Just yep. you better stop yeah. this or we're going to sue you. And he wrote back again saying, since you failed to point out any actual errors, I can only assume that you cannot do so. And then they sued him. So now they're following yeah. through. On the, now, of course, they have deep pockets, right? So they can afford to hire lawyers to go around. They're thugs, right? This is just litigation thuggery. As my friend Orak points out in a very good article going over all the details, which I'll link to if you want to get into this in more detail. So, you know, this is just to point out that this is something that, you know, as podcasters and bloggers, this is a threat that we face, you know, as skeptics, that there are, you know, companies out there, people, individuals who are using the litigation process as an intimidation factor. I think this clearly falls into that basket. And just to give you like the primary point, and I've actually written about this myself, so I've actually criticized them on this exact point before, and that is that, for example, this laboratory, Doctor's Data, will provide urine tests for heavy metals like mercury, right? And they use what's called a provoked test. So they give mm-hmm. the person an oral drug which binds to the mercury and brings it out into the urine. So, of course, you get a spike of mercury in your urine. And then they compare that to normal values that were established for unprovoked mercury levels in the urine, right? It doesn't take a scientist or a genius or a physician to figure out that that's comparing apples to oranges. Yeah, that's not kosher. You know, you're comparing a provoked test to a baseline non-provoked test. Of course it's going to be relatively elevated. So everyone is mercury toxic, you know, according to this. And this is being used by, for example, autism, you know, cranks to treat kids with autism with chelation therapy, you know, based upon these tests allegedly showing that they have mercury toxicity when they don't show anything because they're not being compared to actual normalized relevant data. I mean, this has been brought to their attention. They haven't corrected it. They're clearly not interested in addressing this very legitimate concern. They just want to silence people who are pointing it out. Right, that you know that they're doing tests like this, which are a setup for abuse and are not medically legitimate.
I wonder if we could avoid this by just having a little icon that says on everyone's sort of science based podcast that just says or website that says for entertainment purposes only, and that would ensure yeah. that. I mean, like we know what it really is about, that we're actually dealing with facts and our own sort of the rules that we use to sort of present information is going to remain the same. But if we put that little warning, would that clear everybody right out? Because all those other, you know, bunk fake yeah. sites that do all kinds of stuff, you know, psychic readings and whatever, they have that little warning on there and that gives them sort of carte blanche to do whatever they want. So I wonder if
yeah.
we can have a skeptic version of that, some for enlightening purposes only or...
For enlightening purposes only.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it would help, to be honest yeah. with you. I mean, I see what you're saying.
Grr.
But, you know, like if on science-based medicine or Quack Watch, you know, you're trying to present scientifically legitimate information, there's no way around that fact. You know, putting
right.
a disclaimer in there, I don't think really does much. And also, these lawsuits are frivolous. So
yeah.
it's,
yeah.
you know, you're by definition almost not going to block an intimidation frivolous lawsuit. You know, that doesn't have this lawsuit has no merit in my opinion.
Barrett has a distinct advantage over Singh in that this is happening in America,
right. yes.
in Britain, where the laws are very
yes.
different.
Right.
In which, you know, he's not presumed guilty until he can prove himself innocent.
Exactly.
Right.
But can he sue to get the money back that he spent to defend himself?
You bet he can countersue, and he should if he has to. I would imagine that's going to be part of his any strategy that he and his lawyers, Barrett's lawyers, are going to undertake.
Yeah.
I couldn't see that not being part of the case.
Yeah, it's still, even if the case has no merit, it still takes time and effort and money to defend yourself. And while, again, the libel laws are more reasonable, in my opinion, in the United States over England, you know, it still can be used as a way to of intimidating people. I actually also have firsthand knowledge of other science bloggers who have actually been intimidated into silence because it's of some guy. He doesn't have the time and money to defend himself. And, you know, I'm not at liberty to say who because that's part of the deal. I can't deal with this. So it actually, unfortunately, it actually works sometimes. But you have somebody who's a little bit higher profile and, you know, who's willing to put up with this, like Steve Barrett, you know, that he's gonna ride this through, it seems. But it still takes time and resources away from what he should be doing, you know, which is writing about quacks. Let's move on to your questions and emails. The first question comes from Jason Smith from Columbus, Ohio. And for some reason, Jason addressed this email, this is before we even decided we were going to have George on the show, to Geo and the Rogues. He says, that's right, I am interested in hearing the hosts from both of my favorite podcasts answer to this question that popped into my head the other day. I thought it might be especially interesting to see if your opinions diverged. George, did you get this question separately from us?
I did.
Okay.
I did, yes.
First of all, lots of kudos to all of you. You make my walks to work much more entertaining than they would otherwise be. That's what we live for.
Excellent.
And now on to my question. What is with the flag? I was outside the other day looking up at the flag near my place of employ and started to wonder about the import people put upon that piece of cloth. Up until that point, I never really questioned it. It was an important symbol worthy of our reverence. Then my skeptical brain kicked me in the butt. So what is it in our brains that causes us to basically worship some fabric and dye? And more importantly, is it only Americans or are other countries' cultures the same way? Thanks for your time. Rogely and vibraphonially yours.
Vibraphonially?
Yeah, it's vibraphonally. I guess it's a reference to George.
Vibraphonially, yes.
Right.
Yes. Explain yourself, George. What is that?
A vibraphone is the greeting that people that listen to my show say, so we can just get right to talking. Instead of saying, hey, I listen to your show, I like your show, and blah, 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 they just say vibraphone, and then we just talk.
How come I listen to your show, and I haven't heard that?
Well, because you're not really a fan.
Yeah,
if you were really a fan, you would know this. You would know this about me, Jay.
Well, now I know.
You said vibraphone multiple times during this program, and you haven't even said it once. And it's okay. It's not important, but no. It's from way back, and it kind of spread slowly. And now there's what's neat is you have regionalism. So if you're Australian, you say styrofoam.
That's pretty regional.
It's awful, but it's yeah. So not only will you sit, well, I know that you like the show, but I'll have an idea of what hemisphere you're from. So.
Hey, did anyone else in their head when they were reading this email get Jerry Seinfeld saying it like, what's with the flag? Right?
No. God,
absolutely. I couldn't get Jerry Seinfeld in my head.
Not even a little bit.
Okay, well.
Yeah, I was doing Andy Rooney. What's with this flag anyway?
What's with that whole flag?
I'm old and my eyebrows are scary. No, the eyebrow battle. That would be fun to watch.
Oh, yeah.
Rock'em, sock'em eyebrows.
He's virtually a Mentat. Yeah,
yeah, Steve.
So should we answer his question?
Sorry. Oh, right.
Oh, there's a question.
I think that, yes, we're tribal, and clearly icons speak to us in a very primeval way, I guess. And they speak to our
primal.
Genes.
Primal.
Primal. Primordial? Primal?
No, primal.
Yeah. And, I think this is one of those things that's universal among humans. It's not an American thing at all. And I don't think it's unskeptical either. It's just it's part of the human condition. You know, we get all, you know, warm and fuzzy about things that we care about, our own tribe, our own family, our circle of friends, people who have the same worldview as us and our nation, our country of origin. I mean, and that's okay as long as it doesn't turn into jingoism as xenophobia or, you know, and us versus them dehumanizing things, people that are not in our tribe kind of thing, right?
Right.
Yeah, as long as you're not walking around with like a styrofoam flag or something silly like that.
Right, right. It is iconography, though. There's a great film. I'm sure most of you guys have seen it. Flight from Death, The Quest for Immortality. Have you ever seen this documentary? It's based on a bunch. It's really, really cool, and it talks about this exact thing. It talks about how a lot of religions are sort of based on this idea of a fear of death, and it's this idea of trying to have something bigger and something that continues after we're gone. And
I'd always remember this. Marines die. That's what we're here for. But the Marine Corps lives forever. And that means you live forever.
And in one section, they do these tests where they set people up in these rooms, and the only way they can solve problems is by using an iconic item in a non-iconic way. So at one point, they have to hang a painting on a wall, and they have a nail, and they have the painting, and they have to use a crucifix to nail the nail into the wall, and most people will not do it. There's something else where you have to remove like a marble from a glass full of ink, and the way you sort of do it is you have to use a flag, an American flag, as a filter, thereby ruining the flag, and most people will not do it. And it's this weird thing of the idea of the icon, which you are raised with this icon and you revere it, whatever that icon is, whether it is a crucifix or a Star of David or a Rush album, whatever it is, you imposed some kind of iconic status on it through your parents, through your teachers, through whatever, and that trumps almost everything. So it's a very so if like you're in some kind of a situation where you needed to use a flag to make a splint, you know, for someone's broken arm, or you have to, you know, wrap someone in some kind of a flag because they're on fire, there is this moment of trepidation, and it's a very, very cross-cultural thing of not wanting to use iconic items as day-to-day things. It can lead to this weird kind of thinking, because who's determining what the icons are? Mm-hmm. You know, that's the cultural question that sort of gets raised. Because, yeah, I mean, a crucifix, and then what is a crucifix or what is a flag? You know, when you had this whole flag burning deal, mm-hmm. like, okay, you're not supposed to burn a flag, but can you burn, you know, boxer shorts that have a flag on them? Can you, what if you break a coffee cup that has a flag? Is that as bad as taking a flag? You know, it raises all these weird, weird questions as to what is the icon. I used to be much more sort of pro iconographic respect. And I kind of pulled back away from that because it's just the meaning of it sort of, this is just a random thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, George, you know, it's fascinating the element that you brought to this story or the question. Originally, I thought it was kind of obvious, but now that you bring that into the conversation, like I'm imagining myself using a cross as a tool that could possibly damage it. And even though it doesn't have any real significant meaning,
right, personal
to me,
meaning. Yeah.
I wouldn't want to do that.
Right, right. It's fascinating. It's fascinating, you know, in the same way that you had the same thing like with Stalin and the Soviet iconography, where you had these guys were portrayed as such. There's a great film called The Inner Circle, which is about the Stalin's film projector. The guy that ran movies for him, because he was a big fan of Western movies. And there's this sequence where he accidentally puts like a coffee cup on a newspaper that has Stalin's picture on it, and the guy just freaks, because this is akin to, you know, burning a flag or you know, destroying a crucifix or whatever. And you see that and you say, oh, wow, this is a real state of fear. Gosh. But then it struck a chord with me where I thought, well, wait a minute, there's plenty of things in my existence that I would have a same kind of just even a initial visceral, I shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. You know, like I don't like it. Like when you visit someone like in their office, like I don't like to sit in that person's chair.
Yeah.
You know, like if I've been in the White House, I was luckily in the White House at one point and the guys I was with were kidding around like, oh, I'd love to go in the Oval Office and sit in the president's chair. And like, I would never want to do that. Like that to me, like I wouldn't want to sit there unless I was voted in. You know what I mean? Like I want to earn it. Like this in this weird, or like guys that want to hold Jimi Hendrix guitar or whatever. It's like I don't want to do that.
You know? But you don't really get taught that though. You know, George, like that's you're born with the, or not born, but we're probably both born and partially taught this idea of reverence or whatever. And you're applying that to, like, we could just name random objects, and we probably could find things that equate to the president's chair in your head, you know?
Right, right. Or you know, Kirk's phaser or something. Yeah, like I don't want to hold it because I'm not supposed to until I'm supposed to. Right.
I'm not worthy.
Yeah, until you need to shoot a Klingon. Then you hold it.
Well, yeah, and then you have to.
It's interesting because, you know, we do segregate different types of things, even just neurologically. Our brain processes information about different kinds of things differently. There's a lot of research. We talked a little with Bruce Hood about this on our show, about, you know, certain items have agency, or we perceive them as having agency of being people almost, and other things we think of as things, and Our brains deal with that information differently. And I wonder, I haven't seen this research, but I wonder if there's also a neurological differences in how we deal with icons versus things that do not have some iconic reference to right. them. You know what I mean? Do we imbue them with some kind of essence, for example, like we do with agents? Or is there something else about it? Or is it just what they represent? I mean, I think my thinking was mainly that, like, when I see the American flag, what it means to me is what it represents, you know, the freedoms and the principles that I actually do respect about the Constitution and this country. I think that actually has real meaning, not the piece of cloth. I mean, it's just a...
I would think the piece of cloth is more important because, like, if I see the flag that Francis Scott Key saw when he wrote the Star Spangled Banner, that to me has way more meaning than something made in China that's going to be run up a flagpole anywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, like when I saw Darwin's magnifying glass when there was that exhibit in New York City, I was like almost in tears. Because it just, you realized all of the things that Darwin thought about, kind of this was like the prism that delivered it into his brain. Yeah. And I was so moved. And part of me was, the skeptical part of me was just like, chill, it's just glass and metal.
Right.
You know, there's no magic spirit here of him. But the other part of me, which is, you know, the human, tribal, cultural, 10,000-year atlat throwing guy, was just like, this is amazing. So it's a weird dichotomy.
Well, we can't neuter our feelings, you know? I mean, I think it's awesome that you could be well-developed skeptic and still allow yourself to you know, fall into the mystery right. and the romance of it.
Yeah.
You got to do it. I mean, the fact of the matter is his hand touched that thing.
Right.
You know, and you know what I find, you know, that whole thing about, like, if you have the axe that Washington used to cut down the cherry tree,
right.
but you replace the head twice and the handle three times and isn't the real one.
Right.
It actually doesn't matter that it's the real one. All that matters is that you think it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that's significant.
That is exactly, you know, the essence argument, that you're imbuing some historicity to something that is really.
Right.
A magical essence that's not necessarily anything that's really there. But I agree with you, Jay, that there's a certain romance to it. And my approach has always been, it's okay to embrace the human condition, to experience life as a person, as a human being, and all the emotions that come along with that, as long as you understand them and have some kind of insight and don't let them sweep you away into doing ridiculous, right. irrational things. You know, you got to keep it in perspective, but that doesn't mean being a Vulcan and not experiencing any emotions, right?
Well, Spock had emotion. Okay,
yeah, that's true.
We'll get into that argument now.
He was happy.
Icon thing gets really interesting, because you can, you know, it's a random flag. It's a random piece of cloth that has these colors on it, and it hasn't been through some kind of battle. It hasn't been that actual piece of cloth, or those, you know, two pieces of wood that are nailed together that have the plastic Jesus on it. You know, like that. That is a symbol that sometimes gets fought for in ways, both the flag or the crucifix or the whatever, that gets fought for in ways that can be very unhealthy, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you have to be careful to not, again, like I said, I think the Smithsonian had the Francis Scott Key flag, you know, that he saw. Mm-hmm. And that is just historically fascinating, and it's the flag, so it has that imbued into it also. I don't know. It's a very fuzzy area. It's very fuzzy.
Yeah, I agree.
So before we change the subject, do any of you guys have something that you own that you have imbued with that ineffable essence?
My first skull.
Your skull, like when you were a baby?
Yeah. No, the first skull
I own. He's had three.
George, you may not know this. Bob has a skull collection that is in like the 300s.
Really?
Most of them are fake.
Oh, wow.
It's a piece of jewelry. I have a piece of jewelry that I've owned for a very long time, and it's ridiculous, but it's really important to me. Like if I were to actually get frozen and come back, it's probably the only thing I own that I'd want to take over with.
It's your rosebud?
Yeah.
Rosebud.
Yeah, historical items. I mean, not American history, but things from 10, 20, 30 years ago. Like, I remember going through a box of things that I collected when I was young, and I found old pirate coin that we got when we went to Disney World, and they had they had that little thing that you could buy a pirate coin from this device, and you could punch your initials on it. And I found it, and the thing was like 30 years old. And I was like, I, that just something like that just brings back such memories that I would never want to get rid of that.
You still
things,
have it?
Things, yeah, things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a sentimental connection.
Right.
Connection to
there's
a that,
there's
time
that
in your
aspect
life.
Of it, right.
I've got those, yep.
James Burke talks about that, how he says these items that we have, that most of them are mass-produced. How many items do you have that are unique,
right,
that are one-of-a-kind or even close to being one-of-a-kind that you value? I mean, I don't know how many of those pirate coins were made.
Yeah.
There's probably thousands were made. Who knows how many are left, because it is 20 or 30 years down the road. But at some point, you know, thousands of people had that. And yet for you, it's special.
There is a piece of artwork that hangs on my wall. My mother drew 35 years ago. It's a charcoal sketch of nothing in particular. You know what it is? It's two staple removers kind of inset to each other, one larger than the other. Now, right, it's silly, but it's actually drawn extremely well. It's the only one, and my mother made
it.
That has a lot of, and it's hanging over my desk right now. That has a lot of sentimental value to me. Later.
Let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Now, this week, we have four items. So there are three true and one fiction. And these are science facts, not news items, since we're doing the show a little bit ahead of time, because this is going to be airing on
July 10th.
TAM, actually. Yeah, July 10th, when we're in Las Vegas. So,
happy birthday, Mom.
Yep. Happy birthday, Mom. A little bit too much of a lead time for news items. So I'm just using some science facts. Everybody ready?
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Item number one. The current world speed record for a bicycle is 268.831 kilometers per hour, or about 167 miles per hour. Item number two, while greater than 90% of neurologically typical people are right-handed, only about 45% of people with autism are right-handed. Item number three, Venus is the only planet in the solar system to orbit the sun in retrograde direction clockwise when seen from above. And item number four, identical twins do not have identical DNA. George, as our guest, you have the honor of going first.
Ooh, I get to go first? I get to tee off first.
Yes,
all right. The bicycle one is, you're saying 167 miles an hour on a bicycle?
That's what I'm saying.
See, is that on a flat course, or is that like downhill?
Or flat.
On an owl, that's flat. Maybe some kind of recumbent bike that with a gear system that slowly. Oh, can they like grab onto a car and then let go?
No.
Oh, I think that's what they. No, or do you have? It has to be totally manpowered.
Totally manpowered.
Well, these are all good questions, George. I'm very proud of you.
Oh, thank you. Okay, let me go through the four, and then we'll back up. Okay, 45% of autistic people are right-handed, or not right-handed?
Are right-handed. So 55% are not right-handed.
Okay. You know, that seems just split enough that 5% might be some kind of a cool little anomaly that maybe it deals with left brain, right brain kind of thing. So that might be true. Now, the Venus thing sounds very familiar. The Venus spinning in the wrong direction, but I'm worried that it might be this memory that one of the moons of one of the planets spins opposite to every other one. So now I'm just really confused. The identical twin thing with the DNA do not have identical DNA. Now, does that count like mutations and little things like that? Because if that's, see, I would say that is true. If you're counting little tiny mutations or maybe little tiny things, like in general they do, but three are true, one is fake. I would say the Venus one is the fake one. I think that's the fake one because I know Phil Plate, and I'm just basing it solely on that. I think something has rubbed off. Some astronomical knowledge has rubbed off, and it's just influencing my DNA to say the Venus one is wrong.
Okay,
I think Phil was just exfoliating that day.
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
All right.
Some dandruff.
Evan, go next.
Not crud. How could a bicycle going 167 miles per hour? What is causing that to happen? It's very strange. I don't have an explanation for that one. The next one was 90% of neurologically typical people are right-handed, whereas 45% with autism are right-handed. I don't, you know, again, I really don't know what to say about that. I don't know how to make an educated guess. The third one, Venus, the only planet in the solar system to orbit the sun in retrograde. I thought one of the outer planets perhaps goes in retrograde direction, and I think the inner planets were all going in the correct or right-handed direction. And then number four is a... I think Bob has an advantage here, although he's not an identical twin. He is a twin, and therefore he has psychic powers with his brother, as we all know, as twins do. He has a bit of an advantage on that one, but I believe we've talked about it one time before about identical twins not having identical DNA, so I think that one is true. Therefore, I will go with my instinct, the one I have a little bit of confidence in, that one of the outer planets is the one that goes in retrograde direction. So I'll agree with George that Venus is not the only planet in the solar system in retrograde direction.
Okay, Jay?
Yeah, there's four of them today.
True.
All right, so the current speed record, it sounds like an incredibly large number, 268 kilometers per hour, which is 167 miles per hour for a bicycle. Then what's the definition of a bicycle here? You know, is it just a two-wheeled thing? Because I've seen like two-wheeled kind of looking rockety things, you know, rockets. That could be it. Yeah, you know, I just don't know about that one. Greater than 90% of the neurologically typical people are right-handed. I agree with what George says, and I think I remember something about that. That seems correct. And the Venus thing is confusing to me because I have never seen, as a kid or, you know, recently looking at video of the planets and the way they move, I've never seen any one of them ever moving in the opposite direction. They all move the same rotation around the sun. So I've never seen or heard of any of the planets moving, like spinning in the opposite orbit around the sun. So I'm going to say that one is the fake.
Alrighty, Bob.
All right, so the first one, 167 miles per hour, just seems way too fast for someone to do on a bicycle on a flat ground. Maybe they were drafting. I'm not sure that, you know, whether you go behind a vehicle that where you're actually they kind of just suck you along with them and to help you out with your speed. It takes less effort. Maybe they did that, but still, that just seems too fast. But so that one, yeah, I don't know about that one. The second one, the neurological one. Yeah, I mean, I don't have anything really interesting to say about that. It could be some brain hemisphere issue. You know, it wouldn't surprise me. There's nothing really standing out here that sounds completely out of whack. I don't know enough about autism, but it just kind of makes sense. That doesn't disturb me in the slightest. And the fourth one, the DNA, identical twins. Yeah, there's subtle differences, with the DNA. Everyone thinks that the DNA is absolutely identical. But there are some differences. Now, the third one, yeah, this one's completely whack. I mean, there's no way none of the planets orbit the sun in retrograde direction. You're trying to confuse us, I think. Is it Uranus that its rotation about its axis is, I think it was it flipped on its side, or that's retrograde? But it's, a planet doesn't orbit the sun in retrograde motion because you think about it, you've got a collapsing disk of gas that's slowly orbiting. The star ignites and the planets form, the gas giants, the terrestrial planets form, and they're all spinning in the same direction because of the rotation of that disk. In order to have a planet orbit in retrograde, first off, you have to hit the hell out of that planet with like another planet to put it in the opposite orbit, which would probably destroy the planet, which is to
obliterate
it. Or how
about
it.
A foreign body coming in from
I'm talking now. No, you're right, Jay. You're absolutely right. Either it would be obliterated or knocked out of the solar system, or it could potentially be, I guess, a captured planet that just somehow would orbit in an opposite way, which none of our planets were captured. So that's not it. So that's got to be the fiction. It's not.
Which one do you think is, Bob?
The Venus orbiting retrograde. It can't be right.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank you.
So let's start with item number one.
Wait, this is scary because we all agree. Does that
you
happen?
You all agree.
Yeah,
sometimes. Happens sometimes. Mm. Item number one, the current world speed record for a bicycle is 268 kilometers per hour or 167 miles per hour. Now, this is on a flat surface, totally under the power of a person, so no rockets or holding or on or anything. But this is riding behind a vehicle.
Yeah.
Oh, drafting.
Draft.
Yeah, to block the wind resistance, because you'd never get up to that against the wind resistance.
Who mentioned the drafting, Bob?
Yeah.
Bob, I swear to God, I edited myself, but I almost said, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Drafting. Oh, God, it's awesome.
Yeah, Jay.
Nice.
Yeah, but that is the current absolute bicycling world speed record.
That's wicked.
Held by Fred Rompelberg from the Netherlands.
Oh, hey, Fred.
He's a listener. Yeah. He's a listener.
This bike is going very fast. Wow. I like to pedal very fast on this bike.
Yes. Yeah, but it's totally under his own power. He has to ride behind a dragster. I mean, you need something. And this is on these salt flats, Bonneville salt flats.
Be.
Yeah. Pretty cool. Let's go on to number two. While greater than 90% of neurologically typical people are right-handed, only about 45% of people with autism are right-handed. And that one is science as well.
Cool.
Why? Why is the question?
I bet it's randomized a bit because they're not culturally influenced as much as someone who is not autistic. So it's more 50. No.
No. So it's
not a chance thing?
Their brains are disorganized. So in fact, only about 15 to 20% of people with autism are left-handed, are demonstrably left-handed, or manifestly left-handed. But there's about 30 to 35% that are ambidextrous. So that leaves about 55% that are not right-handed.
Steve, what's the big deal about people being dominantly right-handed? Like, why isn't it 50-50?
Well, why is your heart on the same side? You know, we have right-left asymmetries that are predominating. They're just genetically determined. So interestingly, by the way, so I perused about a dozen websites looking for, weird science facts. And a lot of these websites repeated a lot of the same items, and they got a lot of things wrong. So
I
had to vet the individual items myself. This one was reported as 60% of people with autism are left-handed. It's not true. And 30-35% are ambiguous. Only about 20% are left-handed. And it definitely we're not sure exactly why the numbers are different for children with autism, but almost certainly has to do with just how their brains are organized. Their brain doesn't talk to itself as well as people who are neurologically typical or do not have autism. Genes that affect the organization of the brain are different. So it's not this kind of thing is not a surprise. Let's go to number three. Venus is the only planet in the solar system to orbit the sun in retrograde direction clockwise when seen from above. You guys all thought this one was the fiction, and this one is fiction.
Yeah.
This is the fiction. You guys all got it right.
Yeah, but
I
got it right for the wrong reason, though.
You got it right for the wrong reason. Yeah, you're totally wrong, Evan.
Yeah, Bob clarified.
Several sites reported this as true.
What?
Which is why I included it.
Really?
I read it, I'm like, no way. There's no planet that goes retrograde.
No
but whatever they had. But what is true? Rotates.
What sites? What kind of sites? Like astronomy sites?
No. Like buzzle.com.
Factoid sites.
Yeah, like they're 20 science facts, and they reported this one as a fact. Corrected them, by the way. I left a comment. But it's they got confused. So what did they get confused on? Venus
rotates
in the retrograde.
Yeah. Yep.
It's the
Thank
only
you.
Planet.
So is Uranus.
No, Uranus is tilted 90 degrees. So it's on its side, but Venus is 180 degrees, or it's rotating in the opposite direction of all the other planets.
Right. But they all go around the sun.
But they all go around the sun. They confused. Revolution around the sun with rotation about its axis.
And that might have been caused by an impact, they think, right?
Yeah, probably caused by an impact, not something knocking it on its side. Or it could have just been a wobble in its orbit, and this is how it sorted itself out.
So how does a gas giant like Uranus turn on its face, basically?
Yeah, that was almost certainly it got whacked by something. That's the prevailing idea. Venus also has the distinction of having the least eccentricity, or it's the most circular orbit.
Circular.
Which is another reason why you would not think that it was captured or was too heavily whacked by something.
Right.
It's got almost a perfectly circular orbit, and it's right in the ecliptic. So
I've seen that used as an argument for intelligent design of the solar system too, because it's not spinning in the same direction. You know, logic says everything would be spinning in the same direction, rotating and orbiting together. But because this is going in the opposite way, it's done that way because it's designed that way. As opposed to
God left a clue.
No, I've heard that used as an example, as opposed to being maybe it was hit by something or who knows what.
It's anomaly hunting.
Right. Right.
I heard someone presented the solar neutrino problem to me like 10 years ago as evidence of creation.
No way.
Yeah. It's like, give it a few years. Like, we're on the brink of figuring out the answer to that one. And lo and behold, you know.
And they have.
It's just ridiculous. All right. Which means that identical twins do not have identical DNA. That is science. So they have the same, you know, genetic sequence in that identical twins are produced when a single fertilized egg divides. So you would think, well, it's the same DNA splitting, so it's got to be identical. But a study looking at 19 sets of identical twins found significant differences in the copy number variants. So
Significant?
Yeah. There were different numbers of copies of genes at different locations that they were looking at. So there are certain genes or certain areas of the genome that have more than two copies. Normally you just have two copies, one from each parent. And this can vary anywhere from 0 to 14 copies is a typical kind of range. And these can actually affect phenotype. It can affect...
Really?
Yeah, the biology, the ultimate...
expression, yeah, how they look.
Expression, yeah.
So we really kicked your ass.
You guys did a good job. I mean, I thought that was a little easy, but I had to use it because it was actually listed that way on those sites.
You say that now.
I'm glad I got it. Jeez.
If you look up, because I'm not going to do this again, if you just do like weird science facts and look it up, I mean,
it's true, George.
Most of the sites are just copying from each other, and a lot of the stuff that I have on there is really questionable. Yeah. I had to really dig through. One site, it was like eScience News, had some people think, like Neil Adams, that the Earth is growing.
Whoa.
The growing Earth.
Man. Oh.
And then they said, we said that it was, you know, that not all scientists agree. Oh, come on.
Yeah, but they spelled Earth E-A-R-F, you know, so it's just, that's a giveaway right there.
Jay, do you have a quote for us?
Okay, the quote this week is, "Science has a simple faith which transcends utility. Nearly all men of science, all men of learning for that matter, and men of simple ways too, have it in some form and in some degree. It is the faith that is the privilege of man to learn to understand, and that this is his mission. If we abandon that mission under stress, we shall abandon it forever, for stress will not cease. Knowledge for the sake of understanding, not merely to prevail, that is the essence of our being. None can define its limits or set its ultimate boundaries."
Vannevar Bush.
Vannevar Bush was an American engineer and science administrator known for his work on analog computing, his political role in the development of the atomic bomb as a primary organizer of the Manhattan Project, and... Ooh. The idea of the Memex. Bob, you know what that is?
Is it live or is it
early,
Memex?
Early computer?
Yeah, it's an adjustable microfilm viewer, which is somewhat analogous to the structure of the World Wide Web.
Hmm. Oh, wow. Interesting.
His fingers in everything.
Well, George, it's been a lot of fun having you on the show.
It's been my pleasure, gentlemen. Thank you so much. Really, it's an honor to be included amongst the rogues. Thank you. Thanks for doing what you guys do, too. It's tremendous. Absolutely tremendous, and for me to be a tiny little part of it is really an honor and a privilege, so thank you.
Well, thank you, and you will thank not you, be at TAM in Las Vegas when this show is airing.
No, it pains me so. It pains me so to miss TAM, and I wanted to even go just for a day, even for a couple hours, and I could not swing it. But I am going to TAM Australia, as are you, gents.
Yay!
Very excited for that. Very excited for that.
Very.
Wow. That'll be the next time we're going to see you, because we're not going to Dragon Con this year, unfortunately.
I heard, yes, unfortunately. So
we can't swing it either. Just too much going on. So
Right.
But the next time our paths will cross physically will be...
Yes, with kangaroos in
Australia. And koalas and kookaburras.
And Tasmanian devils.
Exactly. I'll remind everyone to listen to George's podcast, Geologic. It's awesome.
Geologic podcast.
And his latest album, Trebuchet.
Yes. Right. Oh, thank you. If you want to hear the whole record, it's on episode 170.
Well, thanks again, everyone.
Thanks,
thank
Steve.
You, Doctor. Shirley.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.